he knows, he would feel nothing but joy, as the earth is cleansed of its pests. There was a girl, and her uncle sold her. Put like that, it seems so simple. No man, proclaimed Dunn, is an island, and he was wrong. If we were not islands, we would be lost, drowned in each other's tragedies. We are insulated, a word that means literally, remember, made into an island, from the tragedy of others by our island nature, and by the repetitive shape and form of the stories. The shape does not change. There was a human being who was born, lived, and then, by some means or another, died. There. You may fill in the details from your own experience. As unoriginal as any other tale, as unique as any other life. Lives are snowflakes, forming patterns we have seen before, as like one another as peas in a pod. And have you ever looked at peas in a pod? I mean, really looked at them. There's not a chance you'd mistake one for another after a minute's close inspection. But still unique. Without individuals, we see only numbers. 1,000 dead, 100,000 dead, casualties may rise to 1,000,000. With individual stories, the statistics become people. But even that is a lie, for the people continue to suffer in numbers that themselves are numbing and meaningless. Look, see the child's swollen belly, and the flies that crawl at the corners of his eyes, his skeletal limbs. Will it make it easier for you to know his name, his age, his dreams, his fears? To see him from the inside? And if it does, are we not doing a disservice to his sister, who lies in the searing dust beside him, a distorted, distended caricature of a human child? And there, if we feel for them, are they now more important to us than 1,000 other children touched by the same famine, 1,000 other young lives who will soon be food for the flies' own myriad squirming children? We draw our lines around these moments of pain, and remain upon our islands, and they cannot hurt us. They are covered with a smooth, safe, nacreous layer to let them slip pearl-like from our souls without real pain. Fiction allows us to slide into these other heads, these other places, and look out through other eyes. And then in the tale we stop before we die, or we die vicariously and unharmed, and in the world beyond the tale we turn the page, or close the book, and we resume our lives. A life which is like any other, unlike any other. And the simple truth is this. There was a girl, and her uncle sold her. This is what they used to say where the girl came from. No man may be certain who fathered a child, but the mother, that you could be certain of. Lineage and property was something that moved in the matrilineal line, but power remained in the hands of the men. A man had complete ownership of his sister's children. There was a war in that place, and it was a small war, no more than a skirmish between the men of two rival villages. It was almost an argument. One village won the argument, one village lost it. Life as a commodity, people as possessions. Enslavement had been part of the culture of those parts for thousands of years. The Arab slavers had destroyed the last of the great kingdoms of East Africa, while the West African nations had destroyed each other. There was nothing untoward or unusual about their uncle selling the twins, although twins were considered magical beings. And their uncle was scared of them, scared enough that he did not tell them that they were to be sold in case they harmed his shadow and killed him. They were 12 years old. She was called Wututu, the messenger bird. He was called Agasu, the name of a dead king. They were healthy children. And because they were twins, male and female, They were told many things about the gods, and because they were twins, they listened to the things that they were told, and they remembered. Their uncle was a fat and lazy man. If he had owned more cattle, perhaps he would have given up one of his cattle instead of the children. But he did not. He sold the twins. Enough of him. He shall not enter further into this narrative. We follow the twins. They were marched, with several other slaves taken or sold in the war, for a dozen miles to a small outpost. Here they were traded, and the twins, along with 13 others, were bought by 6 men with spears and knives, who marched them to the west toward the sea, and then for many miles along the coast. There were 15 slaves now altogether, their hands loosely bound, tied neck to neck. Ututu asked her brother Agasu what would happen to them. "I do not know," he said. Agasu was a boy who smiled often. His teeth were white and perfect, and he showed them as he grinned, his happy smiles making Ututu happy in her turn. He was not smiling now. Instead, he tried to show bravery for his sister, his head back and shoulders spread, as proud, as menacing, as comical as a puppy with its hackles raised. The man in the line behind Ututu, his cheeks scarred, said, "They will sell us to the white devils, who will take us to their home across the water." "And what will they do to us there?" demanded Ututu. The man said nothing. "Well?" asked Ututu. Agasu tried to dart a glance over his shoulder. They were not allowed to talk or sing as they walked. "It is possible they will eat us," said the man. "That is what I have been told. That is why they need so many slaves. It is because they are always hungry." Ututu began to cry as she walked. Agasu said, "Do not cry, my sister. They will not eat you. I shall protect you. Our gods will protect you." But Ututu continued to cry, walking with a heavy heart, feeling pain and anger and fear as only a child can feel it, raw and overwhelming. She was unable to tell Agasu that she was not worried about the white devils eating her. She would survive, she was certain of it. She cried because she was scared that they would eat her brother, and she was not certain that she could protect him. They reached a trading post, and they were kept there for 10 days. On the morning of the 10th day they were taken from the hut in which they had been imprisoned. It had become very crowded in the final days, as men arrived from far away bringing their own strings and skeins of slaves. They were marched to the harbor, and Ututu saw the ship that was to take them away. Her first thought was how big a ship it was, her second that it was too small for all of them to fit inside. It sat lightly on the water. The ship's boat came back and forth, ferrying the captives to the ship, where they were manacled and arranged in low decks by sailors, some of whom were brick-red or tan-skinned, with strange pointy noses and beards that made them look like beasts. Several of the sailors looked like her own people, like the men who had marched her to the coast. The men and the women and the children were separated, forced into different areas on the slave deck. There were too many slaves for the ship to hold easily, so another dozen men were chained up on the deck in the open, beneath the places where the crew would sling their hammocks. Ututu was put in with the children, not with the women, and she was not chained, merely locked in. Agasu, her brother, was forced in with the men, in chains, packed like herrings. It stank under that deck, although the crew had scrubbed it down since their last cargo. It was a stink that had entered the wood, the smell of fear, and bile, and diarrhea, and death, of fever and madness and hate. Ututu sat in the hot hold with the other children. She could feel the children on each side of her sweating. A wave tumbled a small boy into her, hard, and he apologized in a tongue that Ututu did not recognize. She tried to smile at him in the semi-darkness.
This ends Disc 10. American Gods, Disc 11.
the ship set sail. Now it rode heavy in the water. Hutuhutu wondered about the place the white men came from, although none of them were truly white. Sea-burned and sunburned they were, and their skins were dark. Were they so short of food that they had to send all the way to her land for people to eat? Or was it that she was to be a delicacy, a rare treat for a people who had eaten so many things that only black-skinned flesh in their cook-pots made their mouths water? On the second day out of port, the ship hit a squall, not a bad one, but the ship's decks lurched and tumbled, and the smell of vomit joined the mixed smells of urine and liquid feces and fear sweat. Rain poured down on them in bucket loads from the air gratings set in the ceiling of the slave deck. A week into the voyage, and well out of sight of land, the slaves were allowed out of irons. They were warned that any disobedience, any trouble, and they would be punished more than they had ever imagined. In the morning, the captives were fed beans and ship's biscuits and a mouthful each of vinegared lime juice, harsh enough that their faces would twist, and they would cough and splutter, and some of them would moan and wail as the lime juice was spooned out. They could not spit it out, though. If they were caught spitting or dribbling it out, they were lashed or beaten. The night brought them salted beef. It tasted unpleasant, and there was a rainbow sheen to the gray surface of the meat. That was at the start of the voyage. As the voyage continued, the meat grew worse. When they could, Hutuhutu and Agasu would huddle together, talking of their mother and their home and their playfellows. Sometimes Hutuhutu would tell Agasu the stories their mother had told them, like those of Elegba, the trickiest of the gods, who was great Mawu's eyes and ears in the world, who took messages to Mawu and brought back Mawu's replies. In the evenings, to while away the monotony of the voyage, the sailors would make the slaves sing for them and dance the dances of their native lands. Hutuhutu was lucky that she had been put in with the children. The children were packed in tightly and ignored. The women were not always so fortunate. On some slave ships, the female slaves were raped repeatedly by the crew simply as an unspoken perquisite of the voyage. This was not one of those ships, which is not to say that there were no rapes. 100 men, women, and children died on that voyage and were dropped over the side. And some of the captives who were dropped over the side had not yet died, but the green chill of the ocean cooled their final fever, and they went down flailing, choking, lost. Hutuhutu and Agasu were traveling on a Dutch ship, but they did not know this, and it might as easily have been British, or Portuguese, or Spanish, or French. The black crewmen on the ship, their skins even darker than Hutuhutu's, told the captives where to go, what to do, when to dance. One morning Hutuhutu caught one of the black guards staring at her. When she was eating, the man came over to her and stared down at her without saying anything. "Why do you do this?" she asked the man. "Why do you serve the white devils?" He grinned at her as if her question was the funniest thing he ever had heard. Then he leaned over, so his lips were almost brushing her ears, so his hot breath on her ear made her suddenly feel sick. "If you were older," he told her, "I would make you scream with happiness from my penis. Perhaps I will do it tonight. I have seen how well you dance." She looked at him with her nut-brown eyes, and she said, unflinching, smiling even, "If you put it in me down there, I will bite it off with my teeth down there. I am a witch girl, and I have very sharp teeth down there." She took pleasure in watching his expression change. He said nothing and walked away. The words had come out of her mouth, but they had not been her words. She had not thought them or made them. No, she realized, those were the words of Elegba the trickster. Mawu had made the world, and then, thanks to Elegba's trickery, had lost interest in it. It was Allegba of the clever ways and the iron-hard erection who had spoken through her, who had ridden her for a moment, and that night before she slept, she gave thanks to Allegba. Several of the captives refused to eat. They were whipped until they put food into their mouths and swallowed, although the whipping was severe enough that two men died of it. Still, no one else on the ship tried to starve themselves to freedom. A man and a woman tried to kill themselves by leaping over the side. The woman succeeded. The man was rescued, and he was tied to the mast and lashed for the better part of a day, until his back ran with blood, and he was left there as the day became night. He was given no food to eat, and nothing to drink but his own piss. By the third day he was raving, and his head had swollen and grown soft like an old melon. When he stopped raving, they threw him over the side. Also, for 5 days following the escape attempt, the captives were returned to their manacles and chains. It was a long journey and a bad one for the captives, and it was not pleasant for the crew, although they had learned to harden their hearts to the business and pretended to themselves that they were no more than farmers, taking their livestock to the market. They made harbor on a pleasant, balmy day in Bridgeport, Barbados, and the captives were carried from the ship to the shore in low boats sent out from the dock, and taken to the market square, where they were, by dint of a certain amount of shouting and blows from cudgels, arranged into lines. A whistle blew, and the market square filled with men poking, prodding, red-faced men, shouting, inspecting, calling, appraising, grumbling. Wututu and Agasu were separated then. It happened so fast. A big man forced open Agasu's mouth, looked at his teeth, felt his arm muscles, nodded, and two other men hauled Agasu away. He did not fight them. He looked at Wututu and called, "Be brave!" to her. She nodded, and then her vision smeared and blurred with tears, and she wailed. Together they were twins, magical, powerful. Apart, they were two children in pain. She never saw him again but once, and never in life. This is what happened to Agasu. First, they took him to a seasoning farm, where they whipped him daily for the things he did and didn't do. They taught him a smattering of English, and they gave him the name of Inky Jack for the darkness of his skin. When he ran away, they hunted him down with dogs and brought him back, and cut off a toe with a chisel to teach him a lesson he would not forget. He would have starved himself to death, but when he refused to eat, his front teeth were broken, and thin gruel was forced into his mouth until he had no choice but to swallow or to choke. Even in those times, they preferred slaves born into captivity to those brought over from Africa. The free-born slaves tried to run, or they tried to die, and either way, there went the profits. When Inky Jack was 16, he was sold, with several other slaves, to a sugar plantation on Saint-Domingue. They called him Hyacinth, the big, broken-toothed slave. He met an old woman from his own village on that plantation. She had been a house slave before her fingers became too gnarled and arthritic, who told him that the whites intentionally split up captives from the same towns and villages and regions to avoid insurrection and revolts. They did not like it when slaves spoke to each other in their own languages. Hyacinth learned some French and was taught a few of the teachings of the Catholic Church. Each day he cut sugar cane from well before the sun rose until after the sun had set. He fathered several children. He went with the other slaves in the small hours of the night to the woods, although it was forbidden, to dance the Kalinda, to sing to Dambalawedo, the serpent god, in the form of a black snake. He sang to Allegba, to Ogu, Shango, Zaka, and to many others, all the gods the captives had brought with them to the island, brought in their minds and their secret hearts. The slaves on the sugar plantations of Saint-Domingue rarely lived more than a decade. The free time they were given, 2 hours in the heat of noon and 5 hours in the dark of the night, from 11 until 4, was also the only time they had to grow and tend the food they would eat, for they were not fed by their masters, merely given small plots of land to cultivate with which to feed themselves. And it was also the time they had to sleep and to dream. Even so, they would take that time and they would gather and dance and sing and worship. The soil of Saint-Domingue was a fertile soil, and the gods of Dahomey and the Congo and the Niger put down thick roots there and grew lush and huge and deep. And they promised freedom to those who worshipped them at night in the groves. Hyacinth was 25 years of age when a spider bit the back of his right hand. The bite became infected, and the flesh on the back of his hand was necrotic. Soon enough his whole arm was swollen and purple, and the hand stank. It throbbed, and it burned. They gave him crude rum to drink, and they heated the blade of a machete in the fire until it glowed red and white. They cut his arm off at the shoulder with a saw, and they cauterized it with the burning blade. He lay in a fever for a week. Then he returned to work. The one-armed slave called Hyacinth took part in the slave revolt of 1791. Elegba himself took possession of Hyacinth in the grove, riding him as a white man rode a horse, and spoke through him. He remembered little of what was said, but the others who were with him told him that he had promised them freedom from their captivity. He remembered only his erection, rod-like and painful. And raising both hands, the one he had and the one he no longer possessed, to the moon. A pig was killed, and the men and the women of that plantation drank the hot blood of the pig, pledging themselves and binding themselves into a brotherhood. They swore that they were an army of freedom, pledged themselves once more to the gods of all the lands from which they had been dragged as plunder. "If we die in battle with the whites," they told each other, "we will be reborn in Africa, in our homes, in our own tribes." There was another Hyacinth in the uprising, so they now called Agassu by the name of Big One Arm. He fought, he worshipped, he sacrificed, he planned. He saw his friends and his lovers killed, and he kept fighting. They fought for 12 years, a maddening, bloody struggle with the plantation owners, with the troops brought over from France. They fought and they kept fighting, and, impossibly, they won. On January the 1st, 1804, the independence of Saint-Domingue, soon to be known to the world as the Republic of Haiti, was declared. Big One Arm did not live to see it. He had died in August 1802. Bayoneted by a French soldier. At the precise moment of the death of Big One Arm, who had once been called Hyacinth, and before that Inky Jack, and who was forever in his heart Agassu, his sister, whom he had known as Wututu, who had been called Mary on her first plantation in the Carolinas, and Daisy when she had become a house slave, and Suki when she was sold to the Lavere family down the river to New Orleans, felt the cold bayonet slide between her ribs, and started to scream and weep uncontrollably. Her twin daughters woke and began to howl. They were cream and coffee-colored, her new babies, not like the black children she had borne when she was on the plantation, and little more than a girl herself. Children she had not seen since they were 15 and 10 years old. The middle girl had been dead for a year when she was sold away from them. Suki had been whipped many times since she had come ashore. Once salt had been rubbed into the wounds. On another occasion she had been whipped so hard and for so long that she could not sit or allow anything to touch her back for several days. She had been raped several times when younger, by black men who had been ordered to share her wooden pallet, and by white men. She had been chained. She had not wept then, though. Since her brother had been taken from her, she had only wept once. It was in North Carolina, when she had seen the food for the slave children and the dogs poured into the same trough. and she had seen her little children scrabbling with the dogs for the scraps. She saw that happen one day, and she had seen it before every day on that plantation, and she would see it again many times before she left. She saw it that one day, and it broke her heart. She had been beautiful for a while. Then the years of pain had taken their toll, and she was no longer beautiful. Her face was lined, and there was too much pain in those brown eyes. 11 years earlier, when she was 25, her right arm had withered. None of the white folk had known what to make of it. The flesh seemed to melt from the bones. And now her right arm hung by her side, little more than a skeletal arm covered in skin and almost immobile. After this she had become a house slave. The Casterton family, who had owned the plantation, were impressed by her cooking and house skills, but Mrs. Casterton found the withered arm unsettling. And so she was sold to the Laverre family, who were out for a year from Louisiana. Monsieur Laverre was a fat, cheerful man who was in need of a cook and a maid of all work, and who was not in the slightest repulsed by the slave Daisy's withered arm. When a year later they returned to Louisiana, slave Suki went with them. In New Orleans the women came to her, and the men also, to buy cures and love charms and little fetishes. Black folks, yes, of course, but white folks too. The Laverre family turned a blind eye to it. Perhaps they enjoyed the prestige of having a slave who was feared and respected. They would not, however, sell her her freedom. Suki went into the bayou late at night, and she danced the kalinda in the bambula. Like the dancers of Saint-Domingue and the dancers of her native land, the dancers in the bayou had a black snake as their vodun. Even so, the gods of her homeland and of the other African nations did not possess her people as they had possessed her brother and the folk of Saint-Domingue. She would still invoke them and call their names, to beg them for favors. She listened when the white folk spoke of the revolt in Saint-Domingo, as they called it, and how it was doomed to fail. Think of it, a cannibal land! And then she observed that they no longer spoke of it. Soon it seemed to her that they pretended that there never had been a place called Saint-Domingo, and as for Haiti, the word was never mentioned. It was as if the whole American nation had decided that they could, by an effort of belief, command a good-sized Caribbean island to no longer exist merely by willing it so. A generation of Laverre children grew up under Suki's watchful eye. The youngest, unable to say Suki as a child, had called her Mama Zuzu, and the name had stuck. Now the year was 1821, and Suki was in her mid-50s. She looked much older. She knew more of the secrets than old Sanité Dédé, who sold candies in front of the Cabildo, more than Marie Salopé, who called herself the Voodoo Queen. Both were free women of color, while Mama Zuzu was a slave and would die a slave, or so her master had said. The young woman who came to her to find what had happened to her husband styled herself the Widow Paris. She was high-breasted and young and proud. She had African blood in her, and European blood, and Indian blood. Her skin was reddish, her hair was a gleaming black. Her eyes were black and haughty. Her husband, Jacques Paris, was perhaps dead. He was three-quarters white as these things were calculated, and the bastard of a once proud family, one of the many immigrants who had fled from Saint-Domingo, and as free-born as his striking young wife. "My Jacques, is he dead?" asked the widow Paris. She was a hairdresser who went from home to home, arranging the coiffure of the elegant ladies of New Orleans before their demanding social engagements. Mama Zuzu consulted the bones, then shook her head. "He is with a white woman, somewhere north of here," she said. "A white woman with golden hair. He's alive." This was not magic. It was common knowledge in New Orleans just with whom Jacques Paris had run off, and the color of her hair. Mama Zuzu was surprised to realize that the Widow Perry did not already know that her Jacques was sticking his quadroon little peepee into a pink-skinned girl up in Colfax every night. Well, on the nights that he was not so drunk that he could use it for nothing better than pissing. Perhaps she knew. Perhaps she had another reason for coming. The Widow Perry came to see the old slave woman one or two times a week. After a month, she brought gifts for the old woman, hair ribbons, and a seed cake, and a black rooster. "Mama Zuzu," said the girl, "it is time for you to teach me what you know." "Yes," said Mama Zuzu, who knew which way the wind blew. And besides, the Widow Perry had confessed that she had been born with webbed toes, which meant that she was a twin and she had killed her twin in the womb. What choice did Mama Zuzu have? She taught the girl that two nutmegs hung upon a string around the neck until the string breaks will cure heart murmurs, while a pigeon that has never flown, cut open and laid on the patient's head, will draw a fever. She showed her how to make a wishing bag, a small leather bag containing 13 pennies, 9 cotton seeds, and the bristles of a black hog, and how to rub the bag to make wishes come true. The Widow Perry learned everything that Mama Zuzu told her. She had no real interest in the gods, though, not really. Her interests were in the practicalities. She was delighted to learn that if you dip a live frog in honey and place it in an ant's nest, then, when the bones are cleaned and white, a close examination will reveal a flat, heart-shaped bone and another with a hook on it. The bone with the hook on it must be hooked onto the garment of the one you wish to love you, while the heart-shaped bone must be kept safely, for if it is lost, your loved one will turn on you like an angry dog. Infallibly, if you do this, the one you love will be yours. She learned that dried snake powder placed in the face powder of an enemy will produce blindness, and that an enemy can be made to drown herself by taking a piece of her underwear, turning it inside out, and burying it at midnight under a brick. Mama Zuzu showed the Widow Perry the world wonder root, the great and the little roots of John the Conqueror. She showed her dragon's blood and valerian and five-finger grass. She showed her how to brew waste-away tea and follow-me water and fair-shingo water. All these things and more Mama Zuzu showed the Widow Perry. Still, it was disappointing for the old woman. She did her best to teach her the hidden truths, the deep knowledge, to tell her of Papa Legba, of Mau, of Aidu Huedo, the Vodun serpent, and the rest. But the Widow Perry, I shall now tell you the name she was born with, and the name she later made famous. It was Marie Laveau. But this was not the great Marie Laveau, the one you have heard of. This was her mother, who eventually became the Widow Glapion. She had no interest in the gods of the distant land. If Saint Domingo had been a lush black earth for the African gods to grow in, this land, with its corn and its melons, its crawfish and its cotton, was barren and infertile. "She does not want to know," complained Mama Zuzu to Clémentine, her confidant, who took in the washing for many of the houses in that district, washing their curtains and coverlets. Clémentine had a blossom of burns on her cheek, and one of her children had been scalded to death when a copper overturned. "Then do not teach her," says Clémentine. "I teach her, but she does not see what is valuable. All she sees is what she can do with it. I give her diamonds, but she cares only for pretty glass. I give her a demi-bouteille of the best claret, and she drinks river water. I give her quail, and she wishes to eat only rat." "Then why do you persist?" asks Clémentine. Mama Zuzu shrugs her thin shoulders, causing her withered arm to shake. She cannot answer. She could say that she teaches because she is grateful to be alive, and she is. She has seen too many die. She could say that she dreams that one day the slaves will rise, as they rose and were defeated in Laplace, but that she knows in her heart that without the gods of Africa, Without the favor of Legba and Mawu, they will never overcome their white captors, will never return to their homelands. When she woke, on that terrible night almost 20 years earlier, and felt the cold steel between her ribs, that was when Mama Zuzu's life had ended. Now she was someone who did not live, who simply hated. If you asked her about the hate, she would have been unable to tell you about a 12-year-old girl on a stinking ship. That had scabbed over in her mind. There had been too many whippings and beatings, too many nights in manacles, too many partings, too much pain. She could have told you about her son, though, and how his thumb had been cut off when their master discovered the boy was able to read and to write. She could have told you of her daughter, 12 years old and already 8 months pregnant by an overseer, and how they dug a hole in the red earth to take her daughter's pregnant belly, and then they whipped her until her back had bled. Despite the carefully dug hole, her daughter had lost her baby and her life on a Sunday morning when all the white folks were in church. Too much pain. Worship them, Mama Zuzu told the young widow Pari in the bayou 1 hour after midnight. They were both naked to the waist, sweating in the humid night, their skins given accents by the white moonlight. The widow Pari's husband, Jacques, whose own death 3 years later would have several remarkable features, had told Maria little about the gods of Saint Domingo, but she did not care. Power came from the rituals, not from the gods. Together, Mama Zuzu and the widow Pari crooned and stamped and keened in the swamp. They were singing in the black snakes, the free woman of color and the slave woman with the withered arm. There is more to it than just, you prosper, your enemies fail, said Mama Zuzu. Many of the words of the ceremonies, words she knew once, words her brother had also known, these words had fled from her memory. She told pretty Marie Laveau that the words did not matter, only the tunes and the beats. And there, singing and tapping in the black snakes in the swamp, she has an odd vision. She sees the beats of the songs, the Kalinda beat, the Bambula beat, all the rhythms of equatorial Africa spreading slowly across this midnight land until the whole country shivers and swings to the beats of the old gods whose realms she had left. And even that, she understands somehow, in the swamp, even that will not be enough. She turns to pretty Marie and sees herself through Marie's eyes, a black-skinned old woman, her face lined, her bony arm hanging stiffly by her side, her eyes the eyes of one who has seen her children fight in the trough for food from the dogs. She saw herself, and she knew then, for the first time, the revulsion and the fear the younger woman had for her. Then she laughed, and crouched, and picked up in her good hand a black snake as tall as a sapling and as thick as a ship's rope. Here, she said, here will be our vodun. She dropped the unresisting snake into a basket that Yellow Marie was carrying. And then, in the moonlight, the second sight possessed her for a final time, and she saw her brother, Agasu. He was not the 12-year-old boy she had last seen in the Bridgeport market, but a huge man, bald and grinning with broken teeth, his back lined with deep scars. In one hand he held a machete. His right arm was barely a stump. She reached out her own good left hand. "Stay. Stay a while," she whispered. "I will be there. I will be with you soon." And Marie Pari thought the old woman was speaking to her. Chapter 12. America has invested her religion, as well as her morality, in sound, income-paying securities. she has adopted the unassailable position of a nation blessed because it deserves to be blessed. And her sons, whatever other theologies they may affect or disregard, subscribe unreservedly to this national creed. Agnes Repplier, Times and Tendencies. Shadow drove west, across Wisconsin and Minnesota, and into North Dakota, where the snow-covered hills looked like huge, sleeping buffalo, and he and Wednesday saw nothing but nothing, and plenty of it, for mile after mile. They went south, then into South Dakota, heading for reservation country. Wednesday had traded the Lincoln Town car, which Shadow had liked to drive, for a lumbering and ancient Winnebago, which smelled pervasively and unmistakably of male cat, which he didn't enjoy driving at all. As they passed their first signpost for Mount Rushmore, still several hundred miles away, Wednesday grunted. "Now, that," he said, "is a holy place." Shadow had thought Wednesday was asleep. He said, "I know it used to be sacred to the Indians." "It's a holy place," said Wednesday. "That's the American way. They need to give people an excuse to come and worship. These days people can't just go and see a mountain, thus Mr. Goodson Borglum's tremendous presidential faces. Once they were carved, permission was granted, and now the people drive out in their multitudes to see something in the flesh that they've already seen on 1,000 postcards." "I knew a guy once. He did weight training at the Muscle Farm years back. He said that the Dakota Indians, the young men, climb up the mountain, then form death-defying human chains off the heads, just so that the guy at the end of the chain can piss on the president's nose." Wednesday guffawed.
"Oh, fine, very fine. Is any specific president the particular butt of their ire?"
Shadow shrugged. "He never said." Miles vanished beneath the wheels of the Winnebago. Shadow began to imagine that he was staying still while the American landscape moved past them at a steady 67 miles per hour. A wintry mist fogged the edges of things. It was midday on the second day of the drive, and they were almost there. Shadow, who had been thinking, said, "A girl vanished from Lakeside last week, when we were in San Francisco." "Hmm?" Wednesday sounded barely interested. "Kid named Allison McGovern. She's not the first kid to vanish there. There have been others. They go in the wintertime." Wednesday furrowed his brow. "It is a tragedy, is it not? The little faces on the milk cartons, although I can't remember the last time I saw a kid on a milk carton, and on the walls of freeway rest areas, 'Have you seen me?' they ask. A deeply existential question at the best of times. 'Have you seen me?' Pull off at the next exit." Shadow thought he heard a helicopter pass overhead, but the clouds were too low to see anything. "Why did you pick Lakeside?" asked Shadow.
"I told you, it's a nice quiet place to hide you away. You're off the board there, under the radar."
"Why?"
"Because that's the way it is. Now hang a left," said Wednesday.
Shadow turned left.
"There's something wrong," said Wednesday. "Fuck, Jesus fucking Christ on a bicycle. Slow down, but don't stop." "Care to elaborate?" "Trouble. Do you know any alternative routes?"
"Not really. This is my first time in South Dakota," said Shadow, "and I don't know where we're going." On the other side of the hill, something flashed, redly, smudged by the mist.
"Roadblock," said Wednesday.
He pushed his hand deeply into first one pocket of his suit, then another, searching for something.
"I can stop and turn around."
"We can't turn. They're behind us as well," said Wednesday. "Take your speed down to 10-15 miles per hour." Shadow glanced into the mirror. There were headlights behind them, under a mile back.
"Are you sure about this?" he asked.
Wednesday snorted. "Sure as eggs is eggs," he said. "As the turkey farmer said when he hatched his first turtle, ah, success!" And from the bottom of a pocket, he produced a small piece of white chalk. He started to scratch with the chalk on the dashboard of the camper, making marks as if he were solving an algebraic puzzle, or perhaps, Shadow thought, as if he were a hobo scratching long messages to the other hobos in hobo code. "Bad dog here. Dangerous town. Nice woman. Soft jail in which to overnight."
"Okay," said Wednesday. Now increase your speed to 30, and don't slow down from that. One of the cars behind them turned on its lights and siren and accelerated toward them. Do not slow down, repeated Wednesday. They just want us to slow before we get to the roadblock. Scratch, scratch, scratch. They crested the hill. The roadblock was less than a quarter of a mile away. 12 cars arranged across the road, and on the side of the road, police cars and several big black SUVs. There, said Wednesday, and he put his chalk away. The dashboard of the Winnebago was now covered with rune-like scratchings. The car with the siren was just behind them. It had slowed to their speed, and an amplified voice was shouting, "Pull over!" Shadow looked at Wednesday. "Turn right," said Wednesday. "Just pull off the road." "I can't take this thing off-road. We'll tip. It'll be fine. Take a right. Now!" Shadow pulled the wheel down with his right hand, and the Winnebago lurched and jolted. For a moment he thought he had been correct, that the camper was going to tip. And then the world through the windshield dissolved and shimmered, like the reflection in a clear pool when the wind brushes the surface. The clouds and the mist and the snow and the day were gone. Now there were stars overhead, hanging like frozen spears of light stabbing the night sky. "Park here," said Wednesday. "We can walk the rest of the way." Shadow turned off the engine. He went into the back of the Winnebago, pulled on his coat, his boots and gloves. Then he climbed out of the vehicle and said, "Okay, let's go." Wednesday looked at him with amusement and something else. Irritation, perhaps. Or pride. "Why don't you argue?" asked Wednesday. "Why don't you exclaim that it's all impossible? Why the hell do you just do what I say and take it all so fucking calmly?" "Because you're not paying me to ask questions," said Shadow. And then he said, realizing the truth as the words came out of his mouth, "Anyway, nothing's really surprised me since Laura."
"Since she came back from the dead?"
"Since I learned she was screwing Robbie. That one hurt. Everything else just sits on the surface. Where are we going now?" Wednesday pointed, and they began to walk. The ground beneath their feet was rock of some kind, slick and volcanic, occasionally glassy. The air was chilly, but not winter cold. They sidestepped their way awkwardly down a hill. There was a rough path, and they followed it. Shadow looked down to the bottom of the hill. "What the hell is that?" asked Shadow, but Wednesday touched his finger to his lips, shook his head sharply. "Silence." It looked like a mechanical spider. Blue metal, glittering LED lights, and it was the size of a tractor. It squatted at the bottom of the hill. Beyond it were an assortment of bones, each with a flame beside it, little bigger than a candle flame, flickering. Wednesday gestured for Shadow to keep his distance from these objects. Shadow took an extra step to the side, which was a mistake on that glassy path, as his ankle twisted and he tumbled down the slope, rolling and slipping and bouncing. He grabbed at a rock as he went past, and the obsidian snag ripped his leather glove as if it were paper. He came to rest at the bottom of the hill, between the mechanical spider and the bones. He put a hand down to push himself to his feet, and found himself touching what appeared to be a thigh bone with the palm of his hand, and he was standing in the daylight, smoking a cigarette, and looking at his watch. There were cars all around him, some empty, some not. He was wishing he had not had that last cup of coffee, for he dearly needed a piss, and it was starting to become uncomfortable. One of the local law enforcement people came over to him, a big man with frost in his walrus mustache. He had already forgotten the man's name. "I don't know how we could have lost them," says local law enforcement, apologetic and puzzled. "It was an optical illusion," he replies. "You get them in freak weather conditions. The mist, it was a mirage. They were driving down some other road. We thought they were on this one." Local law enforcement looks disappointed. "Oh, I thought it was maybe like an X-Files kind of thing," he says. "Nothing so exciting, I'm afraid." He suffers from occasional hemorrhoids, and his ass has just started itching in the way that signals that a flare-up is on the way.
He wants to be back inside the Beltway. He wishes there was a tree to go and stand behind. The urge to piss is getting worse. He drops the cigarette and steps on it. Local law enforcement walks over to one of the police cars and says something to the driver. They both shake their heads. He pulls out his telephone, touches the menu, pages down, and finds the address entry marked Laundry, which had amused him so much when he typed it in, a reference to the man from Uncle, and as he looks at it, he realizes that it's not from that at all. That was a tailor's. He's thinking of Get Smart. And he still feels weird and slightly embarrassed after all these years about not realizing it was a comedy when he was a kid and just wanting a shoe phone. A woman's voice on the phone. Yes? This is Mr. Town for Mr. World. Hold, please. I'll see if he's available. There is silence. Town crosses his legs, tugs his belt higher on his belly. Got to lose these last 10 pounds. And away from his bladder. Then an urbane voice says, "Hello, Mr. Town." "We lost them," says Town. He feels a knot of frustration in his gut. These were the bastards, the lousy, dirty sons of bitches who killed Woody and Stone, for Christ's sakes. Good men, good men. He badly wants to fuck Mrs. Wood, but knows it's still too soon after Woody's death to make a move. So he's taking her out for dinner every couple of weeks, an investment in the future. She's just grateful for the attention.
How?
I don't know. We set up a roadblock. There was nowhere they could have gone, and they went there anyway.
Just another one of life's little mysteries. Don't worry. Have you calmed the locals?
Told him it was an optical illusion.
They buy it?
Probably. There was something very familiar about Mr. World's voice. Which was a strange thing to think. He'd been working for him directly for 2 years now, spoken to him every day. Of course there was something familiar about his voice.
They'll be far away by now.
Should we send people down to the res to intercept them?
Not worth the aggravation. Too many jurisdictional issues, and there are only so many strings I can pull in a morning. We have plenty of time. Just get back here. I've got my hands full at this end, trying to organize the policy meeting.
Trouble?
It's a pissing contest. I've proposed that we have it out here. The techies want it in Austin, or maybe San Jose. The players want it in Hollywood. The intangibles want it on Wall Street. Everybody wants it in their own backyard. Nobody's going to give.
You need me to do anything?
Not yet. I'll growl at some of them, stroke others. You know the routine.
Yes, sir.
Carry on, Town.
The connection is broken. Town thinks he should have had a SWAT team to pick off that fucking Winnebago, or landmines on the road, or a tactical friggin' nuclear device that would have showed those bastards they meant business. It was like Mr. World had once said to him, "We are writing the future in letters of fire." And Mr. Town thinks that Jesus Christ, if he doesn't piss now, he'll lose a kidney. It'll just burst. And it was like his pop had said when they were on long journeys when Town was a kid out on the interstate. His pop would always say, "My back teeth are afloat." And Mr. Town could hear that voice even now, that sharp Yankee accent saying, "I got to take a leak soon. My back teeth are afloat." And it was then that Shadow felt a hand opening his own hand, prizing it open one finger at a time off the thigh bone it was clutching. He no longer needed to urinate. That was someone else. He was standing under the stars on a glassy rock plain. Wednesday made the signal for silence again. Then he began to walk, and Shadow followed. There was a creak from the mechanical spider, and Wednesday froze. Shadow stopped and waited with him. Green lights flickered and ran up and along its side in clusters. Shadow tried not to breathe too loudly. He thought about what had just happened. It had been like looking through a window into someone else's mind, and then he thought, "Mr. World." It was me who thought his voice sounded familiar. That was my thought, not Town's. That was why that seemed so strange. He tried to identify the voice in his mind, to put it into the category in which it belonged, but it eluded him. "It'll come to me," thought Shadow. "Sooner or later it'll come to me." The green lights went blue, then red, then faded to a dull red, and the spider settled down on its metallic haunches. Wednesday began to walk forward, a lonely figure beneath the stars, in a broad-brimmed hat, his frayed dark cloak gusting randomly in a nowhere wind, his staff tapping on the glassy rock floor. When the metallic spider was only a distant glint in the starlight, far back on the plain, Wednesday said,
"It should be safe to speak now."
"Where are we?"
"Behind the scenes," said Wednesday.
"Sorry?"
"Think of it as being behind the scenes, like in a theater or something. I just pulled us out of the audience, and now we're walking about backstage. It's a shortcut."
When I touched that bone, I was in the mind of a guy named Town. He's with that spook show. He hates us.
Yes.
He's got a boss named Mr. World. He reminds me of someone, but I don't know who. I was looking into Town's head, or maybe I was in his head. I'm not certain.
Do they know where we're headed?
I think they're calling off the hunt right now. They didn't want to follow us to the reservation.
Are we going to a reservation?
Maybe. Wednesday leaned on his staff for a moment, then continued to walk.
What was that spider thing? A pattern manifestation, a search engine.
Are they dangerous?
You only get to be my age by assuming the worst.
Shadow smiled. And how old would that be?
Old as my tongue, said Wednesday. And a few months older than my teeth.
You play your cards so close to your chest, said Shadow, that I'm not even sure that they're really cards at all. Wednesday only grunted. Each hill they came to was harder to climb. Shadow began to feel headachy. There was a pounding quality to the starlight, something that resonated with the pulse in his temples and his chest. At the bottom of the next hill he stumbled, opened his mouth to say something, and, without warning, he vomited. Wednesday reached into an inside pocket and produced a small hip flask.
"Take a sip of this," he said. "Only a sip."
The liquid was pungent, and it evaporated in his mouth like a good brandy, although it didn't taste like alcohol. Wednesday took the flask away and pocketed it.
"It's not good for the audience to find themselves walking about backstage. That's why you're feeling sick. We need to hurry to get you out of here."
They walked faster. Wednesday at a solid trudge, Shadow stumbling from time to time, but feeling better for the drink, which had left his mouth tasting of orange peel, of rosemary oil and peppermint and cloves. Wednesday took his arm.
"There," he said,
pointing to two identical hillocks of frozen rock glass to their left.
"Walk between those two mounds. Walk beside me."
They walked, and the cold air and bright daylight smashed into Shadow's face at the same time.
They were standing halfway up a gentle hill. The mist had gone, and the day was sunny and chill. The sky was a perfect blue. At the bottom of the hill was a gravel road, and a red station wagon bounced along it like a child's toy car. A gust of wood smoke came from a building nearby. It looked as if someone had picked up a mobile home and dropped it on the side of the hill 30 years ago. The home was much repaired, patched, and in places added on to. As they reached the door, it opened, and a middle-aged man with sharp eyes and a mouth like a knife slash looked down at them and said,
"Yeah, I heard that there were two white men on their way to see me, two whites and a Winnebago. And I heard that they got lost like white men always get lost if they don't put up their signs everywhere. And now look at these two sorry beasts at the door. You know you're on Lakota land?"
His hair was gray and long.
"Since when were you Lakota, you old fraud?" said Wednesday.
He was wearing a coat and a flap-eared cap, and already it seemed to Shadow unlikely that only a few moments ago under the stars he had been wearing a broad-brimmed hat and a tattered cloak.
"So, Whiskey Jack, I'm starving, and my friend here just threw up his breakfast. Are you going to invite us in?"
Whiskey Jack scratched an armpit. He was wearing blue jeans and an undershirt the gray of his hair. He wore moccasins, and he seemed not to notice the cold. Then he said,
"I like it here. Come in, white men who lost their Winnebago."
There was more wood smoke in the air inside the trailer, and there was another man in there, sitting at a table. The man wore stained buckskins and was barefoot. His skin was the color of bark. Wednesday seemed delighted.
"Well," he said, "it seems our delay was fortuitous. Whiskey Jack and Apple Johnny, two birds with one stone."
The man at the table, Apple Johnny, stared at Wednesday, then he reached down a hand to his crotch